VCT Audio, the art of good listening.
My name is Dave Thomas, and I'm a retired police officer. I have interviewed many people over the years. Some have been victims and others suspects. I have supported people throughout the worst time of their lives, and often the worst time of my life. I bring those experiences to these podcasts, interviewing people who have a story to share. Thoughtful and inspiring, some of these stories become a guidebook for others. I would be delighted if you could join me for the Dave Thomas interviews. I'm delighted today to be joined by Tom Juniper, who's a local poet, and we're going to talk about some of his work in a moment. But Tom, just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you found your love of poetry.
Hello, I'm Tom, and it's really difficult to answer that question because I've never not loved poetry. I was literally raised on it. Like, it was always something that was around my house. My mum was an English teacher. There was always like poetry being like quoted and recited. One of my earliest memories is seeing some cake decoration in Cliff Castle in Keighley. For anyone who knows that place, there was some cake decoration and with little rhymes on them, and they'd been read out to me. And apparently I was reciting these rhymes on these cakes for weeks afterwards. So I've literally always loved poetry. I guess I've always written it as well, but I guess I started performing it as soon as I was an adult, and I have ever since. And now I just write it because I like it.
Okay, so what is it about poetry then that grabs you in the way that it does, I suppose?
I think, and I don't know whether this is a thing other people have thought about, but I'm autistic and I like patterns. Like, it's a very autistic trait to like repeating patterns. And I think the fact that poetry quite often has repeating rhythms and rhymes and things like that really attracts me. And it's a way of putting emotions into words that you can kind of look at and understand in a more conscious way. I think that's quite a neurodivergent autistic thing for me. I'm sure there's lots of people who aren't autistic who enjoy poetry as well. But for me, I think that I was initially attracted to the patterns and the rhythms of it.
That's really interesting. I mean, you can say something in normal, everyday language if you want, but then you can say the same thing in the style of a poem, whatever that style is, because there are very many styles, aren't they? But it kind of just adds extra weight to the words, I suppose.
There's a quote that Liz Lockhead said that she was irritated as a child that poetry didn't say things in a straightforward, true way and kind of fiddled around with it. But when she got older, she learned that what poetry does is say things in the truest way possible, ignoring all of the like sentence and structure things that we do for prose, and just try to get the truest thing down however you can. And
well, that's interesting, because I know in police interviewing, you know, there's this mantra of get right to the heart of the matter. Don't mess about. Just get straight in. And I suppose in some ways poetry is similar to that.
Yeah, I think sometimes you do have to mess around to get straight in. You have to find a way into the heart of the matter that might not be the direct way. And just be like, oh yeah, maybe we need to go here and go here to get your brain into the right place to get to where you want to be.
I did a podcast with Ian McMillan last year, and I'll ask you the same question. Do you remember your first poem?
Oh, that's really hard. It's probably a nursery rhyme, to be fair. I think most people's first poem was probably a nursery rhyme, and I think they should get their due in this.
I suppose one that you've written that...
Oh, my first poem that I wrote?
Yeah, that kind of sticks in your mind.
I can tell you that was a poem about space that I wrote in year five at school.
Go on, how old would you be in year five?
I guess 9 or 10, and I can actually recite it for you, because the emptiness Emptiness of space is lonely and cold. It's huge and it's vast and it's centuries old. It's constantly changing and it's never ending. The moon in the sky is ascending, descending. It's really so dead, so lonely, so cold, but of little green Martians from Mars, I am told. Space is so eerie, silent and bare, so why is it people want to go there?
That's amazing that you've remembered it. That obviously means something to you that you have remembered it.
It's more that I'm autistic and I remember rhythms and rhymes and my memory does that. But also, it was probably the first time I got praised for a creative writing thing that I'd done, so it probably stuck in my mind for that.
And that's, you brought me onto something I was going to ask you, is, you know, what do you get out of poetry, personally?
Quite often what I get out of poetry is that I find out what I think about something. Because I'll write something thinking, oh, I'm going to write a funny poem. And I'll write it and it'll be really sad. But, oh, actually, I did have some feelings about that. Or the opposite can happen. I'll be, oh, I'm going to write a really serious poem about this really serious thing that's happened. And I'll write it. And when I read it back, I'm like, oh, actually, I'm quite amused by something about this. There's some dark humour in there. So sometimes it's a processing thing. It's also nice when I read a poem out to people or they read my poem on the page and they get something nice out of it and tell me about it. I'm not going to lie. It's an ego boost when people like your poems.
That's really interesting that you write a poem and you're not entirely sure of the outcome of it.
There was a really interesting one for that. There's a poem I wrote years and years ago called Gormy, which is about interaction with another girl when I was at school. And at the time, I did not know, I hadn't been diagnosed as autistic, but it's very much a poem about being autistic and trying to navigate school social systems and not being able to do it. But I had absolutely no idea what I was writing about. When I came back to it years later, I was like, oh God, like some part of me knew that there was something amiss, but didn't know what to call it. And it came out in my poetry. So I find poetry really interesting.
That is fascinating, that. Well, we're here at the Maurice Dobson Museum, and I know you've written a series of poems about it, but just tell me how you came to become aware of the museum and what was it about the place and its former inhabitants, Maurice Dobson, and his partner, Fred. What was it about their lives that drew you into to the story, I suppose?
Well, you make it sound very organic that I was drawn into it. To be honest, I have been interested in like queer, LGBT plus, whatever you want to call it, history in general, but all specifically in South Yorkshire for years. And I had never heard of this place. I'd never heard of Maurice Dobson. I'd met Ian many times, Ian McMillan, and then I'd met his son also. I'd done some work with Andrew in the past, and they got in touch with me to be say, like, would you like to write some poems about Maurice Dobson? And I was genuinely like, who's Maurice Dobson? And then I found out this story and I was fascinated because I've always been told, oh, like, you'll be okay in the city, but oh, you can't be a gay person or a trans person or a queer person in a little mining village. Oh yeah, you wouldn't survive. No one would accept you. Yeah. And it really turned my ideas of what acceptance looks like and my own ideas of prejudice on their head, because I had some prejudice about, like, people from villages, they're not going to accept me. I can only live in a city. Mm. And yeah, coming here and there being this like queer history icon that everyone's really proud of and really happy about, I was like, oh. And then they're happy to meet me and not weird with me. And I'm like, oh, I was expecting people to be prejudiced against me, but I might be a bit prejudiced against the idea of people from a small mining village being okay with me. So yeah, it was...
It's interesting, isn't it? And maybe your prejudice that you've described is because perhaps of past experiences you may have had. And I'd be really interested to know the experiences of the people of Darfield that makes them non-prejudicial to, obviously, to people like Morris and gay people. Because it is unusual, you're right.
Well, I wonder, I don't know if you've seen the film Pride. If anyone doesn't know, Pride is about the fact that lesbian and gay people in the 80s raised money to support the miners. And then at the end of the film, all of the mining lodges turn up to gay pride, to, and that really happened in, like, I think 1985. Yeah. All the mining lodges turned up to support the lesbian and gay and bisexual and whatever else we say now, community.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's part of it, that there was this understood unity of communities that were being bashed by the government. Of,
it was a common struggle, wasn't yeah. it? I think that's what it was.
Like, yeah, the queer community was getting bashed during the 80s because the AIDS crisis was going on. They were getting the blame for that somehow. The mining community were not having a great time from the government point of view. I think, and that would have been towards the end of Morris's life. And I wonder if the fact that he's so cherished and treasured now is to do with that shared struggle in the 80s where, like, yeah, the mining community and the LGBT community did in some senses come together.
No, it's a very good point you raise. So going on to the museum now then, you've how many poems have you written about Maurice Dobson and the museum?
That's a good question. I'm dyscalculic, and as well as autistic and lots of other neurodivergent fun things. I know all of the poems. I couldn't tell you how many there are. I'd guess around 15, 16.
Wow.
So I'm going to put you on the spot, Tom, if you have a favourite. And it's an unfair question to ask you, but if you have a favourite poem out of all of them, perhaps if you'd like to read it to us?
I do need to do the one with Ken in it.
All right, well, let's start with the one with Ken Brooks, who was a former volunteer at the museum.
Yeah, when I first came to the museum, Ken showed me around and showed me all the amazing stuff in the museum and gave me an education in Darfield history. So, and all the volunteers at the museum are amazing. And I have done all the poems about Morris, but I do also need to give due to the museum itself. So this is called Fine Dining. In Yorkshire, there are various traditions they tell about, at home and far away. But in those lists, there's often one omission, and that is Darfield's Bacon Butty Day. On Saturday, quite early in the morning, a brave, intrepid gang of volunteers get ready, for quite soon and without warning, a crowd of hungry people may appear. Better by far than any pill or ointment, it sets you up a treat without a doubt. Come early or you may face disappointment. The dread words, sorry love, we've just run out. So come and look around at the exhibits while Ken explains the wonders that you see. But don't forget the purpose of your visit, a bacon butty and a cup of tea. So keep your fancy restaurants in Paris. Forget what Jamie Oliver might say. No banquet served in any royal palace compares to Darfield's Bacon Butty Day.
That's brilliant, that, and we are on the first Saturday of the month, and it is Bacon Butty Day today, and it's absolutely rammed in the cafe.
Yeah, we're sitting outside because we couldn't have got a seat in the cafe if we tried. I know that's not a poem about Morris, but I did want to acknowledge the place as it is today and the people who put their time in for it as well.
So we'll have another poem from you in a moment, but let's just talk about those future projects and things that you've gone at the moment that you're involved with.
Well, I'm working currently on a show with Get a Word in Edgeways, which is, and House of the West Wind, which are both storytelling institutions who are supporting me to build some poems that I wrote about monsters and folklore into a more story-ish full show, which will be premiering, I guess, in Dronfield at a storytelling festival that we're planning. So at the moment I'm really stretching myself because I'm used to just writing a poem that might be a minute or 2 minutes long, and now I'm weaving those together into a longer show that's going to have a story and a plot and an arc, and that's quite scary. But
is there a difference, you think, between writing a poem for your own enjoyment and then being commissioned to write a poem? Are those two different processes, do you think?
For me personally, I write better if someone's given me a brief. If someone told me, here's a load of money, write a poem, I would be stuck. But if you say, here's some money, but if you tell me, write a poem about this thing, it helps me to focus in my ideas. And so I like commissions. The money's useful. I like food. I like having a roof over my head, I'm not going to lie. But what a commission does is it gives you a place to start, which is really valuable for me. I really like people to say, here's an idea, go play with that, or we like this thing you've done, do more of that, because it helps me to focus. I always say my problem is I've got too many ideas, right, and I don't know which one to chase. Yeah. If someone gives me a commission, that solves that problem.
But equally, can a commission be, I suppose, restrictive on your ideas?
Yes, that's what's good. I like the, it's like, imagine you're trying to like pour paint onto a canvas and you want it to go a specific way. If you've got no restriction, it goes everywhere. But if there's something holding it down, you still get to direct it, but there's that narrowness that helps you to direct it in the way that is actually going to be interesting.
That's nicely explained. Okay, do you have a poem about perhaps Morris that we could explore?
Yeah, there's one poem that is a take-off of I Went to a Marvellous Party by Noel Coward, which is a story about going out for parties, and that one makes me laugh, but it doesn't really describe Morris, so I'm gonna do this one instead. This is The Fighter, and it's about Morris as a child. There was very little to be found out about Morris's childhood, but one of the pictures that I got from Darfield Library was of Morris and his dad. And I did hear a couple of stories about how his dad did stick up for Morris, but he didn't quite know how to take him. Mm. And didn't quite know how to understand having like what we would now call a queer child, a child who was possibly gay or whatever, or was maybe effeminate. Like, he didn't know what to do with that, yeah, but did nonetheless try to support him the best way he could. So this is a poem about that. When Morris were a bairn, he was just a bit odd. His dad thought his son had a sort of affliction. Wanted a tough, rough-and-tumble lad. Got a soft little sissy the other kids picked on. But he said to him, "Son, don't you put a win out. If somebody starts on you, mind you that you finish it. Stand up to bullies and give them a clout. You're as good as the rest of them. Don't you forget it." A little bit odd. Just a little bit fey. A little bit different. A hop out of kin. But he took Dad's advice, although not in the way that his father intended. He grew a thick skin, toughened up, toughed it out, and he learned how to fight. And if they gave him bother, he'd give them it back. If the bark didn't work, then he'd give them the bite. The best form of defence can sometimes be attack. But it's hard for a lad if he doesn't fit in, and a life down the mine didn't really appeal. If life is a fight, find a fight you can win. And you can't win a fight with the way that you feel. So the soft little lad who liked dollies and dances, the last one you'd expect to go fight in a war, end up a marine. They said, what are the chances? But when fighting's your life, what is one battle more? So never believe it when somebody tells you that lads are a queer, are a limp-wristed and weak. If you're forced into fighting from birth, it compels you to fight. If you're silenced, you might as well speak. But he never forgot the first battles he fought, just to be who he was in the place of his birth. He remembered the lesson his father had taught. You're as good as the rest of them. Show you what you're worth. Could have stayed in the city, lived out his day, but he came back to Darfield and found a way in. Though perhaps there were people who sneered at his ways. He'd a wrong here to right. He'd a battle to win.
Smashing that, it really is. Thank you, Tom. Is there a place where people can find your work, either online or...
I am so bad at this. You can find me on... I think my website's called tomjuniper.com, but I haven't...
That's a good name for it.
I got that far, and then it's just kind of languishing. But at some point, if you look on there, I may have updated on there. Basically, this is what you should do. Google the words Tom Juniper. If it's not an accountant somewhere in Suffolk, it's me. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram. Sometimes I check them. I'm bad at self-promotion.
Oh, bless you. Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
DCT Audio. The art of good listening.